The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. We have no sponsors for this month's program. If you would like to become a sponsor or have any questions, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with the health aspect. Stephen Pete has broken 70 bones and never felt a thing. Now, scientists hope his freak genetic condition would help people with the opposite issue, constant agony, pain relievers. And it's a picture of Stephen Pete. He's a nice-looking young man, male pattern baldness, has got a very high forehead, dark hair, wearing a leather jacket. It looks like he's in a middle-class suburban neighborhood. On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate your pain? Would you say it aches or stabs? Does it burn or does it pinch? Stephen Pate has no idea how you feel. Sitting in a cafe in Longview, Washington, he tells me he cannot fathom aches or pinches, much less the searing scourge of peripheral neuropathy that keeps millions of people awake at night or hooked on pills. He was born with a rare neurological condition called congenital insensitivity to pain. And for 37 years, no matter the wound, he has hovered at or near 1 on the pain scale. Because he never learned to avoid injury, which is the one thing most pain really is good for. He gets hurt a lot. When I ask how many bones he has broken, he lets out a quick laugh. I haven't actually done the count yet, he says, but probably somewhere around 70 or 80. A few years ago, Stephen noticed that the movement in his left arm and shoulder felt off. His back felt funny, too. He got an MRI. The doctor looked at the results and stared at his patient in disbelief. You've got 3 fractured vertebrae. It turned out that Stephen had broken his back 8 months earlier while inner tubing down a snowy hill. Throughout his body today, Stephen feels a weird radiating sensation, as he describes it, an overall discomfort, but not quite pain as you and I know it. He and others born with this condition have been compared to superheroes. He even owns a framed sketch of a character in full body armor with the words Painless Pete. But Stephen knows better. He could feel pain. If he could feel pain, he says, he would probably be constrained to a bed. I worry about him all the time, his wife Jessica Pete says with a sigh, about him working with his power tools and cooking over a grill. If he has a heart attack, he won't be able to feel it. He'll rub his arm sometimes, and I freak out, "Are you okay?" She looks over him, and he chuckles. He thinks it's funny, she says. I don't think it's funny. Pam Costa, who lives about 100 miles away in Tacoma, Washington, is on the other end of the pain scale. The 52-year-old was born with a rare neurological condition called erythromelalgia, otherwise known as man-on-fire syndrome, in which inflamed blood vessels throughout her body are constant sources of pain. Pam wears loose skinning clothes because fabric feels like a blowtorch against her skin. She sleeps with chilled pillows because the slightest heat makes her limbs feel as if they're crackling. Pam takes 50 milligrams of morphine twice a day. A college psychology instructor and the mother of a teenage daughter, she agonizes over her morphine dependency, but if she goes without her medication, her pain becomes unbearable. A year ago, she went to Las Vegas for a work conference, and the plane home got stuck on the tarmac with a mechanical issue. There was no air conditioning, and the temperature started to rise. With her skin throbbing, Pam persuaded a flight attendant to let her off. I was so afraid I was going to pass out or throw up or get to where I was immobilized. Pam and Stephen have never met, and their daily negotiations with the world could not be more different. Yet thanks in part to studies the two have participated in, scientists have uncovered an unprecedented genetic link that binds their mirror image conditions together. Scores of pharmaceutical researchers are now deep into clinical trials on a new type of drug that would mimic Stephen's condition as a way to treat Pam and millions of other chronic pain patients, without the sometimes severe side effects of existing painkillers such as non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as opioids. And there's a picture of Pam. She's a middle-aged lady, obviously 52. Doesn't look very tall. She's sitting on a chair in front of her garage door with her hands in a lap wearing a black outfit. She has fairly light brown hair, and she looks fairly attractive, young lady. If you burn yourself on the stove, it hurts. More specifically, the nerve cells in your hands sense the heat and send signals to the brain to tell you to stop doing what you're doing and get help. Fortunately, most kinds of acute or temporary pain can be treated. Opioids can dull the sting from an incision. Anti-inflammatories can mask the discomfort of a sprain. Chronic pain, on the other hand, never turns off. It can be inflammatory, brought on by diseases such as arthritis, or neuropathic, affecting the nerves as in some cases of shingles, diabetes, and chemotherapy treatments. Some chronic pain can never be traced to a coherent cause. That kind of undiagnosable pain creates its own issues. When Pam was a child, she was sometimes accused of having behavioral problems. In school, she'd sneak off to the water fountain to wipe her limbs off with cold water. She would dawdle in deep gullers near her home. The cool, mucky water provided momentary pain relief. One physician said her symptoms were psychosomatic. Then in 1977, when Pam was 11, a letter from the Mayo Clinic arrived. A cousin had been referred to the medical center after complaining of constant pain. The doctors there discovered that 29 members of Pam's extended family appeared to have erythromelalgia. After learning more about Pam's symptoms, a Mayo researcher told her parents that their daughter had apparently inherited the same problem. Pam was determined not to pass on to her man on fire syndrome. "I had my tubes tied right after my 18th birthday," she says, a hint of grief filling her voice. "Always, since I was a little girl, I wanted to be a mother more than anything in the world." When she got married, she and her husband adopted a daughter. Stephen Waxman was a medical student in the early 1970s when he became fascinated by pain, how people feel it, how the body transmits it, and how, as a future neurologist, he could learn to control it. Later in his career, when his father was in the final stages of agonizing diabetic neuropathy, he became obsessed with helping patients who could find no relief from their pain. "We simply had to do better," he says. Today, Dr. Waxman, 72, is the director of the Center for Neuroscience and Regeneration Research at the Yale University School of Medicine. For much of his career, he has been interested in sodium channels, portals that allow charged particles to flow in and out of nerve cells. In particular, he believed that one of those channels, NAV.1.7, played a powerful role in how we experience pain. In his theory, a stimulus triggers the NAV.1.7 channel to allow sodium ions to pass through, which then enables messages of stinging, soreness, or scalding to register on the brain. When the trigger subsides, NAV.1.7 closes. In those with certain mutations in their NAV.1.7 channels, sensations that typically wouldn't register with the brain are instead translated into extreme pain. In 2004, Dr. Waxman's team was searching for subjects with some form of inherited pain so they could determine exactly how NAV1.7 channel worked, to either cause or dampen painful sensations. That same year, scientists in a Beijing lab published the results of a study of a Chinese family affected with a man on fire, in which they linked the disorder to mutations in a single sodium channel gene, SCN9A. When Dr. Waxman spotted the article, he directed his team to find families with erythromelalgia. Pam Costas was the first. Dr. Waxman's team gathered DNA for 17 of Pam's cousins, aunts, and uncles who suffered from the disease and sequenced their genes to find the mutations. Then the team introduced the mutations into DNA that encoded normal sodium channels and tracked how these channels responded to stimuli. The results proved Dr. Waxman's theory correct, not only demonstrating that SC9A mutations made NAV1.7 channels more likely to open, meaning harmless stimuli often triggered feelings of pain, but also showing that when those channels opened, they did so for far longer, amplifying the feeling of discomfort. We now had a fully convincing link from NAV1.7 to pain. If his team could somehow regulate or even turn off NAV1.7 channel, they could regulate or turn off how we experience certain kinds of pain. At around 6 months old, Stephen Pete chewed off part of his tongue. As he got older, he would bang his head against walls. His parents made him wear a helmet and wrapped his arms and legs in long socks. His younger brother Chris had many of the same symptoms. A day rarely passed when one of them didn't bleed or bruise. The boys were eventually diagnosed with congenital insensitivity to pain. Some years later, a doctor told Chris that a lifetime of injuries had caused so much damage he would likely end up in a wheelchair before he was 30. It was too much for Chris to bear. He hanged himself 9 years ago. He was only 26. "I felt like losing my life," Stephen says. In the meantime, outside Vancouver, British Columbia, a small company was inching towards a breakthrough in understanding the brother's condition. The company, which is now called Xenon Pharmaceuticals, studied rare single-gene disorders in an effort to create drugs to treat more common ailments with similar symptoms. In 2001, it heard about a family in Newfoundland in which four members could not feel pain. Suspecting their illness was genetic, Xenon started hunting for more subjects. Following news reports and word of mouth, the researchers tracked down and studied 12 families with insensitivity to pain. The Peets were not among them. Xenon found one common trait, mutations in a single gene, SCN9A, and the sodium channel it encodes, NAV1.7. The single channel, when it is malfunctioning in a human being, renders them unable to understand or even feel any form of pain, Robin Sherrington, Ph.D., then Senior Director of Biological Science at Xenon, says. If Xenon could develop a drug that mimicked this condition to inhibit the NAV1.7 channel to partially replicate that absence of pain, he explained it could use it to relieve chronic pain without any of the other side effects of opioids and other painkillers. It is rare for a single gene to have such a black-and-white effect on a single sensation. Sherrington's and Dr. Waxman's teams learned of each other's discoveries only through published reports and journal articles. They were as surprised as anyone that people like Pam Costa and Stephen Pete had anything in common. I was overwhelmed when we saw both sides of the genetic coin, Dr. Waxman said. SCN9A really is a master gene for pain. Technicians at Xenon eventually found a compound that plugs up NAV1.7 without major side effects. Unfortunately, when it was tested on 330 patients who suffered from nerve pain, the results were disappointing. After 4 weeks, their pain levels did not improve significantly. At Yale, Dr. Waxman and his researchers helped Pfizer test five erythromelalgia patients with a different NAV1.7 blocker. Scientists triggered the subject's pain with heating blankets. Three of the patients described a decrease in pain after taking the drug. There are other, less conventional approaches underway, too. At Amgen, a pharmaceutical company in Thousand Oaks, California, scientists discovered that a toxin of a Chilean tarantula can target NAV1.7. They've since engineered a synthetic version that's more potent than the original. There are still obstacles to finding a treatment, such as creating compounds that will allow some pain to register without cutting it off altogether. But many now see a way forward. I hope, says Stephen, that one day patients will be able to make a choice for their children who don't feel pain to activate that sodium channel so that their children can live a normal life. No progress would have been made without people like Pam and Stephen, who have taken part in the studies for years. Pam still remembered meeting Dr. Waxman at Yale in 2011, 6 years after his team first reached out to her family to study their genes. On a computer, he pulled up an image of the nearly folded amino acids that form a normal pulse of sodium channel. Then he pulled up another image, the amino acids zigzagged almost off the screen. "This is you," he said. Her entire life, Pam could only tell others how she felt. She could never show them. Seeing the medical proof of her pain, she says, was the most validating experience in my entire life. On the other hand, the work to target NAV1.7 channel won't help Stephen or others with congenital insensitivity to pain. There's no point blocking a portal that's permanently closed. The condition remains one with a known cause, but no cure passed down from one generation to the next. When his daughter was born in 2008, Stephen asked the doctor in the delivery room, "Does she feel pain?" "They pricked her," his wife remembers, "and she cried. It felt something like relief." The stranger who changed my life. He walks up to her in dire need of medical attention. She's a young mother, is already feeling overwhelmed, but after she reaches out to this person in need, there is no turning back. She lifted a finger. I sit on the stoop in front of my friend's house. She lives at the top of a ridiculously steep hill. Halfway up, my 4-year-old daughter, Colleen, collapsed in mutiny, refusing to take another step, and I had to lug her the rest of the way on my back. And now my friend is late, and we're stuck here waiting at the 4 p.m. San Francisco fog rolls in, kicking up gritty wind and making the temperature plummet. My friend's street is so traumatically narrow and steep, the drivers, upon discovering it's a dead end, have to back down the hill because there's no place to turn around. I know, because that happened to me once, which is why I walked here today. I see a man approaching, and I think, oh, great, now what? Poor before, Call 911, the man says. Finger cut. He holds up his blood-streaked forearm with his left hand. He is clenching a wad of handkerchief around the right pinky. No half phone, I say, as if English is also my second language. Half phone, he says, and dips his chin toward the front pants pocket. I don't want to stick my hand in there, but the blood does look real in his pocket. I find a flip phone. I slip it out and step back of arm's reach, then call 911. The operator answers, and after I give her the address, I say, I'm here with this guy, and he says he cut his finger. Is it bad? The operator asks. Is it bad? I ask him. Si. It's bad, I tell her. Did he cut it off? Now, there's a question I hadn't thought of. Did you cut it off? Si, he sighs, relieved someone finally understands the gravity of a situation. Yes, he cut it off. Where is it? The operator asks. Where is it? My voice goes so high and tight my throat burns. Upstairs, he says, and points to his elbow at the house next door. Go get it, she instructs me. I admonish Colette. Do not move a muscle. And I leave her sitting on the stoop as I follow the man towards the house. Inside, we are immediately greeted by a staircase that is missing all of its treads. I follow the man up the stairs, balancing on narrow vertical strips of wood, narrating to the 911 operator. We have entered the premises and are ascending the stairs. We get to the kitchen. I see a table saw, a stack of lumber, and an arc of blood spatter across the ceiling. But I don't see the finger. We are attempting to locate the finger, I say, because even in an emergency, silence over a phone is awkward. I thought a severed finger would jump right out me, but I can't find it. I lift up each foot and look underneath to be sure I'm not already stepped on it. I'm getting the jumpy, fight-shouldered feeling like when you've lost sight of a spider that was on your ceiling a moment ago. Do you see it? I ask him. He points with his elbow at his own finger. The finger lies on the floor beside the table saw, drained of color and curved slightly. I don't have any rubber gloves or tongs, so I grab a paper towel and lay it over the finger, pinching delicately, the way you might pick up a harmless but terrifying bug. We have secured the finger, I tell the operator. Hang tight. The ambulance is on its way. I cradle the swaddled finger back down the skeletal stairs, being careful not to squeeze too hard. I don't want to collapse all of the designate little doodads on the business end, because I'm assuming they'll need those when they reattach it. When we get outside, Colleen is still sitting there where I left her. It's still daylight, which surprises me because it felt as if we'd been our finger recovery remission for hours. We sit on the stoop and wait for the ambulance, which we can hear in the distance. We listen to the siren growing louder as the ambulance approaches, and just when we are expecting to see the flashing lights at the bottom of Treat Street, the siren begins to grow quieter and quieter, as if the ambulance is driving away. The man looks at me with the whites of his eyes showing all the way around. Sounds like they're going to the wrong way. Are they leaving? I ask the operator. After a brief silence, he returns with, They couldn't find you. The street does not exist. The address does not exist. I sit up straight. No. Tell them to come back. We're on the other side of the park. Drive around the park. I tell the man, It's okay. They'll be here soon. I can see the fear that has been staving to off overtake him. A tear appears on the rim of his eye where it balances for a second before it spills out and runs down his cheek. I don't know what he's thinking, but I'm thinking, what if he has a wife and kids depending on him, and he can't go back to work? What if he doesn't have insurance, or isn't in the country legally? You're going to be okay, I say. I put my free hand on his awkward, sudden-dovered back. Gracias, he says. De nada. Este no problema, I say, emboldened enough to risk managing my middle school Spanish. I rub my free hand in a circle on his back. It feels good to be able to soothe someone, anyone. For months now, the second my hands would go idle, a familiar specter, depression, would climb on my back. I've been this way for months. I've been trying to put a good face for my kid, but I feel as if I've been failing. Could I save myself? I wouldn't know how, but I am determined to save this man. Finally, the ambulance arrives. They hustle him in the back, and they're off. Colette and I are watching the ambulance back down the hill when I realize I'm still holding the finger. I run after them, waving my arm, screaming, The finger! Stop the finger! I hand the finger off to the paramedic and watch as they drive away. Throughout the evening, I can't stop worrying about the man I decided to call the hospital. I can't stop worrying about the man I decided to call the hospital. Hi, I say. I helped a guy who cut off his finger, and I don't even know his name, but I'm wondering whether he came to your hospital. The nurse says, Kim? Yes, I say, feeling mystified. It's me, Catania. Catania is the mother of one of my daughter's classmates. I find it miraculous that she recognizes my voice. She says, "His name is Jose Ramos, and he's waiting for surgery. Would you like to leave a message?" "No, I don't want to bug him. I just wanted to be sure he was okay." The next morning, I call the hospital again. This time, I'm put through the Jose's room. "How was the surgery?" "No surgery," he says. "Not enough blood," whatever that means. "Oh, I'm sorry," I say. "Do you need anything?" Jose says, "No, gracias," then launches into Spanish. I can't understand what he's saying, but I can hear in the tone of his voice the same letting your guard down feeling I feel, which makes sense. It's impossible to be the carrier of a person's chopped-off body part and not feel a little camaraderie. I presume that's true of the carryee as well. Later that day, as I'm pushing Colette on the tire swing in the park, I remember that old proverb about how if you save someone's life, you are responsible for them for the rest of their life, which never made sense to me before. Shouldn't the person who got saved owe a perpetual debt and not the other way around? But today, I get it. It's a great honor to help someone in need, even if all you did was push three buttons on a phone and carry a couple of ounces of former human for 15 minutes. I want to keep doing it. I start keeping a lookout for other people in need of rescuing. I help push a stalled car out on the road. I aid a disoriented cyclist when her bike gets clipped by a car. I flag down a security guard in a lobby when I see an elderly man stumbling and clutching his chest. I adopt a dog. Then one day, a month or two after the finger incident, I realize I've completely forgotten to be depressed. I've been so busy playing the role of local hero that I've neglected to drag my feet and stare into space and fantasize about the world without me. When I stop moving, melancholia no longer drops an anchor. Now, more than a decade has passed since Jose's accident. Periodically, I search for Jose plus Ramos plus Finger. I wish I could see him again to see how he's getting on, but more important, to thank him, because when he lost his finger, he saved my life. Food for thought. Just finished the holiday box of Ferrero Rocher. I am now 13% hazelnut. I don't understand that. The lack of paparazzi at this barbecue makes me think that my aunt can probably stop referring to her potato salad as famous. Inspiration. Why a grieving widow, a Minnesota high school, and a Nebraska online community are devoted to helping people they've never met. Perfect strangers. And there's a picture of three people, a young woman, a boy, and a girl. And I say that because the young woman's kind of hard to tell how old she is. I would say probably in her 30s. The boy's a teenager, as is the young girl. It's Tyra Dam, far left, with her children, Cooper and Katie. When Tyra Dam, and her last name is D-A-M-M, when Tyra Dam lost her husband, Steve Dam, to brain cancer in 2009 after 15 years of marriage, her heart broke for herself and her kids, then ages 4 and 8. And in the opaque blur of that first year, one day stood out on his birthday. It was the hardest day for them all, full of unbelievable grief. Almost out of desperation, she hatched the plans for Steve's next birthday. She would use it to help people she'd never met. On November 4th, 2011, Tyra asked her friends in her Texas community to perform random acts of kindness in Steve's honor. Hundreds of people responded. A movement and the hashtag DamnKind was born. In the years since, DamnKind has been passed along and expanded, moving people Tyra had never met to do good deeds, buying coffee or ice cream for a person in line behind them, leaving a note of gratitude and a large tip for a waiter, baking cookies for Meals on Wheels. November 4th, says Tyra, a 46-year-old middle school teacher and parenting columnist for the Dallas Morning News, is my favorite day of the year. Doing good in her husband's hashtag name is a natural extension of who he was, a health-conscious marathoner. Steve was diagnosed with glioblastoma, an aggressive tumor in his brain, in 2007. He began chemotherapy while still working as an administrator at a medical clinic for underprivileged children. Tyra used her blog not only to record the DamnKind deeds, but also to spread the word about Steve. The website contains a card that people can print and give away as they perform an act of kindness. It reads, "This gift is given in memory of Steve Dam. His life was cut short by brain cancer, but his legacy continues. He loved kindness, and he loved life. I'm happy to share some of that life with you." Tyra estimates that DamnKind followers complete at least 400 acts of kindness in 2017. After Steve died in 2009, Tyra says she was overwhelmed by the way her neighbors in Frisco, Texas, came together to help her family with rides, meals, babysitting, and more. Repaying their support for her and especially for her kids helped fuel her mission. The movement has helped the children, Cooper now 16 and Katie 12, make positive connections as they grieve. They don't have the same memories I do, Tyra says. It's a way for them to see what was important to Steve is still important to us. Some years after their dad's birthday, the kids beg for neighbors or give out pencils to classmates. They always give their teachers a small gift. My hope is that their grief is comforted by the goodness of his life and not the hard reality of his death, Tyra says. I hope this helps keep that goodness around. And there's a picture of a set of steps, and it's below, and there's a gentleman sitting at the top, and on the steps are writings. Say hello, share your talents, give more high fives, share more jokes, chase rainbows, believe in magic, kindness matters. Our high school's high spirits. At many schools, getting kids to pay attention to the morning announcements is nearly impossible. But at Coon Rapids High in Coon Rapids, Minnesota, they are a can't-miss part of the day. The rural school has managed to enlist a series of famous folks, professional athletes, singers, and television personalities, in a noble project recording short videos about the importance of kindness. The school's year-long Kindness Matters campaign is led by special education teacher and designated kindness coordinator Jamie Wise. Wise is also a network coordinator, and he has Sweet Talk celebrities such as Tom Brady, Alex Trebek, Robin Roberts to appearing in the school's announcements, which are broadcast on the smart boards in each classroom. The videos have been a huge hit with students and even staff, Wise says. I've had students come up to me to see if I can get a favorite actor or rapper to do a kindness message. But videos are only one part of the campaign. Students also participate in kindness contests, charity drives, and kindness themed pep fest throughout the year. We need to challenge kids to make kindness a priority, Principal Annette Ziegler said, as she told the Star Tribune. Then there's a picture of a bunch of like soldiers. Riverside, California, Tommy Marr, wearing red in this picture, treated One Armor recruiting station to a meal from Subway in honor of Las Vegas shooting victim Angela Gomez. And there's all these soldiers standing around, black, white, Hispanic. Highway to Heaven. On November 7, 2017, New York firefighter Tommy Marr set off on an 18-day, 9,500-mile trip to some of the most ordinary places in America. They did, however, all have something else in common. Each town had been home to one of the 58 victims in the October shooting in Las Vegas. Marr wanted to honor them by performing an act of kindness for the victims' neighbors. He was inspired by a fire department friend who died during the 9/11 rescue. That man's body was never found, and since then Marr has been determined to mark the death of others in noble ways. First stop on his tragedy-inspired trip was Shippensburg, Pennsylvania, the home of Bill Wolf, Jr. Marr's good deed there was at a laundromat, where he taped envelopes filled with quarters to each of the machines so that patrons could have a free wash. In other cities, Marr left a large tip for his server, bought lunch for the staff of a pediatric urgent care clinic, or simply offered strangers a flower. At each stop, he gave one person in the community a bracelet bearing the name of his mission, Honor 58, as well as the name of that community's victim. The person with the bracelet promised to continue the mission of spreading kindness. Marr documented his journey on Honor 58's Facebook page. Before long, his Facebook followers, some of whom had survived the Las Vegas shooting themselves, took up Marr's cause and began launching their own 58 Act of Kindness. Many of these survivors have emotional and physical scars from that day, says Marr, and in a way, they found these Act of Kindness to be an avenue to begin to heal. Mending Fences. For most of her life, Kellen Nightingale of Lincoln, Nebraska, says she was more likely to donate her money than her time. But after watching social ruptures that emerged from the 2016 presidential election, that changed. I knew that while I couldn't fix the world, I could affect what was around me, my family, and our city, she says. And there's a picture of her with her young daughter. She launched a Facebook group called Make Lincoln Kind Again. Members have made cards for seniors, assembled hygiene bags for women in need, and gathered supplies for an incoming refugee family. There's some karma at play, too. When Nightingale had a stroke in January, members rallied to make hospital visits and look after her kids. It's amazing to see people you barely know come out of the woodwork to support you, she says. Being nice isn't hard, and it doesn't have to cost a thing. Tune in, turn on to kindness. Many of the entrees in our 2017 Nicest Places in America search were built on kindness. In Ottawa, Illinois, strangers in a grocery store line paid the bill of an older woman ahead of them who had lost her wallet. In Pittsfield, Maine, residents sometimes found their lawns mowed by a mystery neighbor. If you find selflessness to be both uplifting and entertaining, check out Random Acts. It's a TV show where the producers set up a hidden camera, create a moral dilemma such as finding a wallet on the sidewalk, and then record what happens. The April 3rd season premiered on BYU TV includes segment including Gallatin, Tennessee, a place where people are so nice the town won our 2017 Nicest Place in America search. You can also watch the show at randomaxtv.com. And this is a little late, but it's still interesting. 13 things you didn't know about Mother's Day. If I'd known this was in here, I would have read it when I first started this one, but I didn't. Who knew? These high school proms weren't beyond memorable. They became famous across the... I'm sorry. Things about Mother's Day. Hang on a second. I'm having a problem with the computer here. Oh, there we go. It was all started by a mom, of course. Ann Reeves Jarvis arranged Mother's Friendship Day in West Virginia back in the 1860s, and she had a surprisingly serious purpose. A social activist and mother of 13, Jarvis hoped the special day would quiet the seething animosity between Union and Confederate soldiers, in addition to their families and neighbors at the end of the Civil War. Number two, her daughter took it very seriously, too. After Ann Jarvis died in 1905, her daughter, Anna M. Jarvis, made it her mission to take Mother's Day national. Anna never had kids, but you could say Mother's Day was her baby. She campaigned for years against what she saw as its commercialization from candy to store-bought cards to a 1934 postage stamp. If the American people are not willing to protect Mother's Day from the hordes of money schemers that would overwhelm it with their schemes, then we shall cease having a Mother's Day, she wrote. Number three, Tommy loved his mommy. It was President Thomas Woodrow Wilson, Tommy to his family, who made Mother's Day a national holiday in 1914. 26 years after his mother's death. I remember how I clung to her, a laughed-at mama's boy, till I was a great big fellow, Wilson wrote in a letter to his wife. But love of the best womanhood came to me and entered my heart through these apron strings. Number four. The French once gave medals to their mothers. After their enormous losses in World War I, more than 4% of the population was killed. The French were desperate to rebuild the country. So the government celebrated Mother's Day in 1920 by presenting women who had five children with a bronze medal. Mothers of eight got silver, and those with 10 or more got the gold. Number five. In Mexico, it starts with a bang and a strum and a toot. Dia de las Madres, which is always on May 10th, is one of the biggest holidays south of the border for restaurants and for mariachi bands because the high-demand families often hire a band months in advance to perform just for mom. And children rouse her in the morning with the traditional song, La Mamanitas, as a precursor of the shore to come. Number six, expect a crowd at the restaurant. More people eat at restaurants on Mother's Day than any other day of the year, with 92 million Americans dining out with mom. The second busiest day is Valentine's Day, which makes sense. Or you could just call her. Mother's Day is also the busiest day of the year for phone traffic in countries all around the globe. Number eight, you can never go wrong with a bouquet of carnations. America spent $2.4 billion on Mother's Day flowers in 2016, compared with $792 million on cards. Carnations are the traditional bloom of choice for mom. Even Anna Jarvis sent them. In case you're wondering whether you're a big enough spender, the average Mother's Day bouquet costs about $29. Number nine, she is definitely worth the money. Insure.com Mother's Day Index estimate that it would cost $67,619 a year to hire someone to do all the household tasks that mom does for free, cooking, cleaning, kissing, boo-boos. That's about as much as the average accountant or chiropractor makes. Number 10. This mother deserves a hand and a nap. India's Day Jalandhar Kaur was believed to be in her early 70s when she gave birth to a bouncing baby boy on April 19, 2016. Kaur and her 17-year-old husband, Mohinder Singh Gill, spent decades trying to have a baby and finally succeeded after saving up enough money for fertility treatments. Number 11. Becoming a future mom is good for your brain. Pregnancy not only alters a woman's skin and hair, but may affect her brain. According to a small 2010 study published by the American Psychological Association, the changes include a small but significant increase in gray matter in the parts of the brain responsible for sensory perception, reasoning, and judgment. These changes may play a role in shaping maternal behavior and motivation in the development of higher cognitive functions. She's got the same, number 12, she's got the same name in every mother tongue. Babies in nearly every country on the planet speak the word mama in almost exactly the same way. That's interesting. Number 13, but don't accuse her of smothering you. A motherload of words with mother as the root. Perhaps the most recent is motherboard, the main circuit of a computer. A surprise to some is that a smother doesn't come from the same source, no matter how much you think it's in your mom's DNA. Essential abbreviations for your work emails. T apostrophe DR, too long, didn't read. R apostrophe TD, read some, read some, then deleted. SS apostrophe IC, saw subject, ignored completely. TI apostrophe SS, totally irrelevant, still sending. DR apostrophe ARA, didn't read, accidentally replied all. SU apostrophe SDR, saw urgent, still didn't read. OV apostrophe SE, on vacation, stop emailing. SOV apostrophe SSE, still on vacation, seriously, stop emailing. WR apostrophe GF, won't read, got fired. WI apostrophe MS, where is my stapler? Who knew? These high school proms went beyond memorable. They became famous across the nation. The dance of a lifetime. Does thinking back to your senior prom still make you smile or make you queasy? In either case, May is part of the prom season, which is a shame we're reading this in June, but hey, that works, which makes this good time to promenade, yes, that's where the word comes from, through some of the most noteworthy dances since the first co-ed mixes between Smith and Amherst colleges in the 1890s. Number 1. Heartbreak Hotel. He had a funny name, Elvis. He wore funny clothes, too. Instead of the standard white tuxedo, he was dressed in a dark blue suit and, no joke, blue suede shoes. Yet the most surprising thing about Regis Wilson's date for the 1953 prom at Humes High School in Memphis, Tennessee, was that the future king of rock and roll said he couldn't dance. Instead, 18-year-old Presley and his 14-year-old partner spent their evening quietly sipping sodas and watching the other couple swinging on the dance floor. Wilson somehow misplaced her prom photo, but Presley held on to his, and he looks miserable in it. But things soon change for the guy in the slick back hair and long sideburns. He obviously learned to dance, and he also found the proper venue for those suede shoes. And there is a picture of him, and he really does look miserable. Number 2, presidential party crashers. It takes guts to show up at a senior prom without a date. Fortunately, when President John F. Kennedy crashed the John Burroughs senior prom on June 7, 1963, he brought comedian Jack Benny with him. California Democrats were hosting a fundraiser in the Beverly Hilton Hotel, the same night as the prom. But after Kennedy learned that this had almost caused the dance to be relocated, he stepped in, literally. The president walked into the hotel's grand ballroom and declared to the stunned seniors, actually, this is a better room than the room we have upstairs. And there's a picture of Kennedy with Jack Benny, and it looks like probably a high school senior with a bow tie. Party at the White House, number 3. In 1975, Susan Ford accomplished something no other teenager in history could boast. She persuaded her dad, a.k.a. the President of the United States, to host her senior prom at the White House. The event, held in the East Room on May 31, 1975, was attended by 74 students from Washington's exclusive Holton Arms School and their very well-behaved dates. For the record, the government didn't pay a penny for the soiree. The girls raised the $1,300 necessary for the dance through bake sales and other fundraisers. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough to hire their band of choice, the Beach Boys, who seriously entertained the offer. Number 4, breaking a barrier. In 1997, actor Morgan Freeman approached a high school in Charlton, Mississippi, and offered to pay for its senior prom on one condition. It had to be racially integrated, something that had never happened before in Freeman's hometown. The school board turned him down, but when Freeman returned with filmmaker Paul Saltzman in 2008, they agreed to hold the first interracial prom on the school's history. Saltzman documentary Prom Night in Mississippi, which followed the prom's development as well as local resistance to it, was later nominated a top prize at Sundance Film Festival. And it shows a picture of the integrated prom, which is kind of interesting. A white girl and a black girl are dancing together in the floor surrounded by white people and black people, all in their fancy dresses. Number 5, The Last Waltz. What's the longest a lady should wait to be asked to a dance? For Rockford, Ohio resident Dolores Dennison, the answer is something north of 70 years. Dolores was 89 when she first asked to a senior prom, and she went on the arm of her great-grandson, Austin Dennison. He wanted to make up for the fact that Granny D.D. never attended hers, and he pulled out all the stops. They went to at a Bob Evans, her favorite, boogied when the band played the Frank Sinatra song Dolores, and beamed when the youngsters at Parkway High School gave them a standing ovation. Now that's what you might call an awesome senior's prom. And there's a picture of the lady. She's a little tiny gray-haired lady, and her great-grandson looks like he's about 6'4", football player. Okay, let's do a little word power thing. How well do you know the peaks and valleys of planet Earth? Can you tell a bluff, that's a cliff, from a gulch, a narrow ravine? Circumnavigate your way through this list of words and scroll down for the answers, but we don't have to scroll down because I've got them right here. Number 1, biosphere. Is it a gases around the Earth, parts of Earth that support life, the planet's outer crust? The biosphere is parts of the Earth that support life. The biosphere is home to a stunning variety of species, from tiny microorganisms to enormous whales. Strata, rock layers, low clouds, or seabed? It's a rock layer. Did you know that the strata of the Grand Canyon are hundreds of millions of years old? Bayou, tropical island, deep cavern, marshy waterway. A bayou is a marshy waterway. Marie often paddles down the bayou in her home state at Louisiana. Arroyo, is it at a gully, a grassland, or a coral island? An arroyo is a gully. That's my car at the bottom of the arroyo, officer. Cartography, is that a study of glaciers, an act of map-making, or a science of erosion? Cartography is an act of map-making. Why would any study cartography in the age of Google Maps, Dora asked. Seismic, prone to floods, related to earthquakes, covered in lava. Seismic, so related to earthquakes. After moving out west, Nick got used to the regular seismic activity. Scree, that's S-C-R-E-E. Loose rocks, peninsula, magma flow. Scree is loose rocks. Petra had to scramble through piles of ankle-wrenching scree to reach the summit. Ecology, relationship of organisms to their environment. Cycle of some currents, composting. Ecology is a relationship of organisms to their environment. Scientists are studying the ecology of the effect of oil spills on deep sea ecology. Terra firma, natural dam, sandbar, dry land. Terra firma is dry land. After a week on the rickety sailboat, Alex couldn't wait to return to terra firma. An aquifer. A geyser, a waterfall, an underground waterbed. An aquifer is an underground waterbed. The Ogallala Aquifer stretches all the way from South Dakota to Texas. Flora, animal life, plant life, or minerals? Flora is plant life. Walzak inspired by the flora of Cape Cod. Tarn, that's T-A-R-N. Mountain lake, a sinkhole, or fossilized wood? Tarn is a mountain lake. A dip in a tarn is just as bracing as a shot of espresso. Latitude. Distance east or west from the prime meridian. Imaginary line through the Earth's center. Distance north or south from the equator. The latitude is the distance north or south from the equator. Lines of latitude are called parallels. That means longitude is the other way around. Primordial. Densely forested, on highest ground from earliest times. Primordial is from earliest times. This primordial forest looks like something straight out of the Game of Thrones. Hogback. U-turn in a river, steep-sided ridge, or a tributary. A hogback is a steep-sided ridge. Honey, I'm not sure you should take a selfie so close to the hogback's rim. Polar opposites. When you were a kid, did you ever try digging into China or Australia or whatever was down there? I did. Points on Earth are opposite each other, such as the north and south poles, are called antipodes. The word comes from the Greek anti, opposite, and pod, foot, meaning people who have their feet against our feet. So whose feet are pressed against yours? Probably no one's. In most of America, your antipod is in the Indian Ocean. Last week we did a couple of that outrageous. We had one left on there that we didn't do. An Indiana hotel asked a guest to write an online review. So she did. About the whiff of sewage in her room, the non-working air conditioner, and the low water pressure. Oh, and the hairs on the bed. I wasn't crazy about that either, she told RTV6.com. The hotel, it turns out, says it can charge customers $350 for negative reviews. The Indiana Attorney General wasn't crazy about that. He says the policy is unfair, abusive, and deceptive, and is suing the hotel. Okay, here's something that's kind of silly. Humor. Were you bored silly in civics class? Then you'll love laughing at Socrates, Lincoln, Caesar, and more. The history of the world and dumb jokes. Jurassic period, dinosaurs. Why can't you hear a pterodactyl go to the bathroom? Because the P is silent. 1323 BC. King Tut dies. Why was King Tut so irresistible? It was in his pheromones. Circa 469 BC. The birth of Western philosophy. Who was Socrates' worst student? Mediocrates. Who was his busiest student? The one with a lot on his Plato. Burp. 27 BC to AD 476, the Roman Empire. What did Caesar say when his friend asked how many oranges he'd had? Et tu, Brute? 221 BC, these are terrible. 221 BC, China begins construction on an enormous fortification. Why did Mark Zuckerberg visit Beijing? To see the Great Firewall. Oh, that's awful. 5th century to 15th century, the Middle Ages. Who was the rounded knight at King Arthur's round table? Circumference. Ha, 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 ha. 6th century, first great Mayan city reaches its peak. Knock, knock. Who's there? A Mayan. A Mayan who? A Mayan the way? Circa 1275, Europe meets Asia. Which explorer was the best at hide and seek? Marco Polo, of course. 1492, Christopher Columbus comes to America. What vegetable did Columbus not want on a ship? A leek. 1509, the new Tudor king is crowned. Who invented fractions? Henry I8. 1620, the Mayflower arrives at Plymouth Harbor. What did one turkey say to the other when they saw the pilgrims? They look nice. Maybe they'll have us over for dinner. 1687, Sir Isaac Newton publishes his landmark book on physics. What did Newton's doctor tell him when the apple fell on his head? I don't think you understand the gravity of this situation. 1775, the American Revolution. Who yelled, the British are coming? Oh, I'm sorry. Who yelled, coming are the British? The Paul reverse. Oh, that's terrible. Excuse me. 1789, George Washington elected presidents. Why do cherry trees smell? Because George Washington cut one. Oh, God. These are middle school jokes. 1789, the French Revolution. What happens when a guillotine operator is fired? He gets no severance pay. 1848, the Communist Manifesto is published. Why did a communist fail at school? He got bad marks. 1861, the war between the states. Civil War jokes? General Lee didn't find them funny. 1886, Lady Liberty is dedicated. What does the Statue of Liberty stand for? It can't sit down. 1703, first airplane flight. Why did Wilbur and Orville invent the airplane? Because if someone else had been the first, you wouldn't have been right. 1912, the Titanic sinks. What do you get when you cross the Atlantic Ocean with the Titanic? Halfway. 1914, World War I. What did the German Kaiser Roll say to the French baguette? Guten Tag. 1929, the stock market collapses. How many stockbrokers does it take to change a light bulb? Two. One to take out the bulb and chop it and drop it, and the other to sell it before it crashes. 1939, World War II. Did you hear about the schizophrenic who thought he was both Adolf Hitler and Winston Churchill? He was his own worst enemy. 1961, the Bay of Pigs invasion. How did Fidel Castro find out about the Bay of Pigs? Someone squealed. 1969, Americans land on the moon. The Soviets respond by announcing that they would be sending a man to the sun. American engineers objected. If you send a man to the sun, he will burn up. The Soviets replied, What do you think we are, stupid? We'll send him at night. 1972, Watergate. Did you hear about the Watergate watch? Both hands always point to Nixon. 2015, Queen Elizabeth II becomes Britain's longest-serving monarch. Why is England the wettest country? Because the Queen has reigned there for years. Well, we don't have much time left since I ran through that Reader's Digest pretty quick, so I'm going to start next month's Reader's Digest, which is actually this month's Reader's Digest, and we'll read a little bit from that, and then we'll go ahead and close. Dear readers, this is from the editor. My routine when faced with a home repair task has been the same for my entire adult life. Upon begrudgingly starting a project, I will hit a snag, instantly mutter, this is impossible, and seconds escalate to call the handyman as if something were on fire. Lately, this is sop-seeing sitcom.cute. It's embarrassing. So I got up the nerve to call Gary Wentz, patient and droll. He's the editor of The Family Handyman, one of our sister publications, and a reason I'm newly embarrassed. I can't imagine his respecting a colleague who's afraid of a wrench. Gary, that's him above, and there's a picture of Gary. He actually looks something like the editor. Listens to my tale. I'm impatient and clumsy with mechanical things, I say. No one in my family fixed stuff. His reaction, repair pros have a name for clients like you, he says. The guy who paid for my boat. Gary starts by appealing to my vanity. You are as smart as or smarter than any pro, right? He next describes the rewards of change. Recently, he decided to repair his truck's bulky transmission, about which he knew zilch, and felt his ego do a happy dance when it worked. I was just so pleased with myself. Finally, he does some accounting. A handyman charges $100 just to walk through the door, he says. And the time. You set up appointments, stay home from work, and then do it all over again when he doesn't show up. His conclusion. What's the worst that can happen? You're not going to wreck the house. You can always call a pro later. I bet you won't, though. It's remarkable the difference it makes when you become just willing to try. Next thing I know, I spotted a fix for our sputtering bathroom faucet in this issue's cover story, which Gary helped edit. I unscrewed the faucet's tip. I didn't even know it came off. Use an old toothbrush to scrub away the residue from inside it and screw the tip back on. In 5 minutes, the water is flowing as powerfully as Yosemite Falls. Thank you, friend. As you promised, I like the feeling. Letters. Comments on the April issue. World of Wonder. I thought the pictures in your cover story were gorgeous as well as tender, like the newborn baby yawn featured in the gallery. By the way, I love the cover, too. Perfect orchid color, and I'm sorry some of my readers could not see that, because it was beautiful. 25 Ways Sugar Make You Sick. Here's another thing to add to your excellent list. Normally, good bacteria in the microflora of the gut flourish and keep bad bacteria under control. Excessive sugar consumption feeds the bad bacteria, destroying the healthy gut balance. This contributes to health problems, including a weakened immune system, diabetes, obesity, autoimmune diseases, and has been linked to heart disease and cancer. Librarians who rescued opioid victims. I saw The Librarian Who Saves Lives on your cover. I was expecting a cliched story about librarians teaching literacy in after-school programs or helping unemployed adults build resumes. I was thrilled to read about the librarians on the front lines, helping to reverse overdoses and combat the opioid crisis. This is not an inner-city problem. This is an every-city problem. I hope your article will shed light on this crisis and help reduce the stigma. The case of the illegal vegetable garden. I have a solution. This couple should do away with their formal garden and plot and landscape their front yard with edibles. What's to say their sidewalk has to be lined with lyre rope? Why not a nice border of kale? Did Miami Shores Village ban flowers? If not, okra produces a beautiful large flower. Are bushes allowed? Time to put in a few blueberry bushes. A border of cabbage around the bushes would look nice, too. Considering that most produce travels an average of 1,500 miles from farm to plate, instead of harassing this couple, the village should give them an award for environmental stewardship. Showing your appreciation. Inspired by the article regarding the value of thank you notes, I wanted to say thank you for publishing a quality digest without the ugliness of depressing content of other publications these days. I'm a big, burly, heavy metal head-banging biker type, but I've yet to read through an issue without laughing out loud numerous times or gasp, actually shedding some tears. Don't tell anyone or ruin my image. Watch out for these 8 phone scams. Another phone scam to watch out for is the grandparent scam. My 89-year-old mother fell for this one, fully believing her grandson had been in a car accident and needed $7,000 to keep the woman he supposedly hit from suing him. Her grandson had his attorney on the phone to work out the details for the money transfer. She was one of the lucky ones who got her money back. We need to spread the word. If a loved one calls with a story like this, ask a question that a stranger wouldn't be able to answer. Better yet, don't answer calls from numbers you don't recognize. The Kids Book Club. We know we have an audience of readers, so we're not surprised that many of you enjoyed Once Upon a Time Again, in which Bruce Handy praised rereading children's books as an adult. When the April issue arrived, I was reading for the first time in 50 years my favorite book from 7th grade. I found The Sherwood Ring by Elizabeth Marie Pope just as intriguing as an adult. After he outgrew my bedtime stories, my 11-year-old liked to read Animorphs books in bed. One night, his 4-year-old sister copied him. So I asked her, "Marianne, what's your book about?" Her answer, "Well, I tell you, Dad, but you wouldn't understand." And let's close out with a little humor in uniform. During World War II, my father often found himself stuck with KP duty. One day, convinced he could improve things, he told the head cook, "If you give me a paring knife, I could peel those potatoes faster." The cook turned slowly to my father and said, "Son, you're in the Army. You have plenty of time." Dad always bragged about the gunners on a ship. Once during target practice, an unmanned drone flew past an anti-aircraft cruiser. The cruiser opened up with shells furiously flying all around the drone but not hitting it. Then came Dad's ship turn. The gunners went very first shot, sent the drone into the water. 40 years later, Dad met the man responsible, and he told him how impressed he had been. "Yeah, I got a lot of trouble for that," the gunner said. "Turns out we were supposed to shoot around it, not hit it." And with that, we are just about out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the reading service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much for listening.